front of me, the playground was empty, except for a green plastic hoop, which had been discarded in the middle of the tarmac, and the remnants of colourful chalk marks on the ground, only partially washed away by the rain. I got out of the car.
"Be warned that the school's hired security,"
Chang said as we crossed the playground to the entrance.
"Because of the press. They caught a journalist snooping in the school office."
As we walked, my legs felt as though they weren't working properly. There was faintness in my head and my chest. Everything seemed to take on a cartoon-like quality. I visualized the press as an invasive plant, its roots and tendrils growing implacably into every area of my life and Ben's, looking for action or information to feed off. I felt distinctly unwell, and I wondered if I should go back to the car and let Chang go in without me. But we'd arrived at the door by then, and to articulate how I felt was impossible. We were admitted to the building by a burly man who I'd never seen before. He had a shaved head, an earpiece, and a strikingly large beer belly. He checked Chang's ID and then let us in. I led the way to Ben's classroom. All I wanted was to get Ben's PE kit from his peg, and anything else he might have left behind. That's what I would normally have done at half-term. I would have washed his kit and checked he had everything he needed for the next few weeks in the run-up to Christmas. Not to do that would have felt wrong. It wasn't to be that simple, though. As we neared the door to Ben's classroom, I saw a big display of artwork, and in the middle of that display was a picture that I recognized, because Ben had made it. My knees buckled. After that, I have only snatches of memory and sensation. Confusion when I came round, because I was on the floor of the corridor and Chang was propping me up. Eyes refocusing again on the display of artwork, seeing painted leaves and branches and all the shades of brown and orange and green and black that wrapped themselves around Ben and swallowed him up when we were in the woods. Seeing Ben's picture amongst the others and feeling sure that I could see the imprint of his fingers and the smears of paint. Feeling an impulse to stand and put my fingers where his had been, and then an inability to do that. When they'd got me upright and they were sure I wasn't going to faint again, they moved me into the classroom and sat me in the teacher's chair. Miss May was there and also the teaching assistant. I heard Chang's voice saying,
"She wants his things, that's all. That's why we're here."
I watched Miss May go over to a row of pegs that ran along one wall of the classroom and take down the only PE bag that remained there, and behind it there was a label. It was a photograph of a dog, black and white like Skittle, and the name Ben F. Then Miss May said,
"Lucas, can you please get..."
And I watched the teaching assistant go into the corridor and carefully take down Ben's painting from the autumn display and put it into a plastic folder. Noticing his receding chin and very red hair. Noticing the sweat under his arms. Then Miss May was offering to help me to the car, but I found my voice and said no, because I didn't want the fuss of it, and Chang said we could manage just fine. Outside in the corridor, with her arm linked firmly around mine, we walked past the new headmaster. He said,
"I'm so sorry."
But the way he looked at me made me feel like an exhibit, though I didn't reply. I just wanted to be at home. Miss May ran down the corridor behind us, her shoes tapping fast, and just as we reached the door, she caught up with us. She had an armful of Ben's books, which she passed to me, and she said,
"I thought you might like these, since you didn't make it to the parents' evening this week. I thought you might like to look through them."
So I took them, and as Chang helped me into the car, I held them to myself, as carefully as if they were an actual baby.
Jim. Addendum to D.I. James Clemo's report for Dr. Francesca Minnelli. Transcript recorded by Dr. Francesca Minnelli. D.I. James Clemo and Dr. Francesca Minnelli in attendance. Comments to indicate observations on D.I. Clemo's state of mind or behaviour, where his remarks alone do not convey this, are also included. So, the letter. We threw everything into it, obviously. Was that your call? It was Fraser's. Actually, it was both of ours, and it was the right one. Was the investigation team excited? You're always excited when you've got a lead, but you had to be cautious too. You don't want mistakes. But it was a development, and that was good, because by then it had been 5 days, and that was getting to people. They were tired. The media were going insane around us. We had the blog to worry about. What was happening with that? Behind the scenes, Fraser was putting everything she could into finding out who might be behind it. Amongst others, we were looking at Laura Saville and Nicola Forbes as possibles for the leak. We knew that both of them were involved in online journalism in some way already, and they were obviously close to the heart of things. She had to be discreet internally, though, partly because we didn't want to put the wind up anybody if they were up to something, and also because everybody working the investigation was feeling the pressure. That kind of thing is very bad for morale, putting it mildly. Including you? Were you feeling the pressure? Of course. There was a kid's life at stake. And did you have any strategies to cope with that? He speaks to me as though I am an imbecile. A little boy, 8 years old, was still missing after 5 days. We didn't have time for coping strategies. Okay, I understand that it must have been a stressful period for everyone involved in the investigation. My question is... He interrupts me. His temper has risen. Don't patronize me. I'm not intending to. That's a very defensive reading of what I said. I'm simply acknowledging the fact that you felt under pressure and looking at ways that we might explore what that meant for you and for the investigation. You have no idea what it's like to be in the middle of something like that. So would it be fair to say that by this point in the case, you'd moved on from the attitude that you felt when you took on the case, the bring it on attitude? It would, yes. Because have you ever thought about what 5 days of being removed from your family and living in fear could do to a child? That's 120 hours and counting. That was on my mind every single second. Why do you think I threw a hand grenade into the middle of that family? Because that's what it was, making Nicky Forbes confess that stuff to her sister. Don't think I don't understand that. But I did that for Benedict, because we had to find him. And if there was collateral damage, then so be it. The letter was no different. I end our session here because I fear I'll push him away entirely if I press him further today. I do wonder whether, if this man doesn't successfully go through this process and get back to work in CID, I might fear for his long-term stability.
Rachel. When I got home, Chang asked me if I wanted her to come in with me, but I declined, saying that my sister would be there, even though I didn't know if that was true. I still felt detached and strange, as if all my senses were dulled and the only thing that mattered were the thoughts that were at a rolling boil inside my head. Nicky was there. She was sitting in the kitchen and her packed bag was by the front door, her coat draped over it.
"I waited because I didn't want to leave without saying goodbye," she said.
She didn't notice my disorientation. She did ask me what I was cradling in my arms.
"Ben's books,"
I said. I put them carefully down on the table, and then we just stood facing each other, and she reached forward to hug me. It was an awkward hug, just as it had been the first morning at the police station, although this time it was worse, because her body offered none of the softness that it had before. We were both too wary of each other, and we made do with the minimum of contact, because for the first time in our lives, neither of us knew where we stood with the other. And then, as if she knew that was inadequate, Nicky stood in front of me and put her hands on either side of my arms and rubbed them up and down.
"Will you be okay?"
she asked. I nodded.
"I can come back whenever you want. Just call me. If it's too much being on your own."
"I can ask Laura to come over," I said.
And my voice sounded strange, as if I was speaking with a thick tongue. She hesitated just slightly before saying,
"Okay, good."
Then we stood there again, and her hands fell away from my arms, and she looked at me in a way that made me want to start screaming with the uncertainty and the awfulness of it all. So with the last reserves of my strength, I said,
"Just go, Nicky." "Now, I'm not sure I should," she said. "Looking at you now, you're not okay, are you?"
And I shouted. I shouted,
"Just go!"
Because I felt as if I would implode if anybody said anything else to me. And it shocked her so much that she took a step back, and from her reaction I could tell that my expression must be ugly. She stared at me and then started to say something, but I couldn't stand to hear it, so I shouted,
"No!"
And it was more of a scream than a word. And then I ran up the stairs so fast that they pounded, and I didn't hear the sound of the door clicking shut behind her. But I did hear the press badgering her to tell them who had been shouting and why. And as she replied to them, she did it very quietly, or not at all, because within minutes, all I could hear were the sounds of my empty house. Laura came to mop me up. I didn't ask her to, she just arrived. As I went to answer the door, I heard her chatting with one of the journalists on the doorstep. When I let her in, she said,
"How funny! I trained with one of those guys out there."
She said it lightly, as if they'd run into each other at a party. I wondered which one of them it was. There were a few regulars. Most likely, I thought, to be the youngest of the bunch, the one who could outrun the others and was the last to stop beating on the windows of the car when I was driven away. I didn't ask her. She'd brought takeaway food and a bottle of wine with her. Before she arrived, I thought I'd tell her everything that had happened, but I didn't. I couldn't find the words. They felt trapped inside me, made prisoner by my numbed senses and my decaying ability to trust. Within my head I was jittering, like a withdrawing addict, obsessing over my sister and what she'd told me, replaying my loss of consciousness at the school. Laura let me jitter. She calmly laid out our food on the kitchen table and poured us glasses of wine. "I know you probably won't feel like this," she said, "but I'm going to do it anyway, and I won't be offended if you don't want it." The food and drink she'd brought looked like ancient relics of a life that I'd once enjoyed, but I went through the motions of appearing grateful. I picked at one or two of the dishes, managed just a sip of the wine, which had lost all of the comforting qualities it had before Ben disappeared, and tasted like acid in my mouth.
"Do you want to talk about him?"
Laura asked, breaking our silence.
"Would it help?"
Laura never ate much. She had the appetite of a sparrow. She toyed with her food for a few moments, while I failed to answer her question. And then she said,
"Do you remember when you had him? At the very beginning? We can believe how tiny he was. Do you remember that?"
I found my voice.
"You wouldn't hold him at first?"
Laura hadn't been able to take her eyes off him when she came to see me in the hospital. I lay exhausted in the bed, my body bruised and sore, hormone-drenched and soft, and watched her while she'd stood beside his perspex crib, all trim and well-dressed and tanned and pretty in a little summer dress and big sunglasses pushed up on her head, like a postcard from my life before motherhood. I told her she could pick him up, but she'd shaken her head at first. She smiled at the reminder.
"I'd never held a baby before. I didn't want to break him or drop him.
But I made you.
And he puked on me."
"He puked everywhere for the first few months. It was constant washing."
"It was love at first sight, wasn't it? For you?"
"Yes.
I envied you that. It was so intense, so private."
Her fingers sat on the stem of her wine glass and she turned it slowly, delicate wrists flexing. Then she refilled it. More than half the bottle was gone, and I hadn't had more than a sip. For the first time, I noticed that lines were beginning to form on her elfin face. It was just an impression. They seemed to be there one moment and gone the next. But they were a reminder that she was aging. That we were all aging. I stretched my hand across the table towards her, and our fingers linked briefly.
"I can't believe this is happening to you," she said. "It's like a bolt of lightning came out of nowhere and struck you and Ben. I can't imagine what you must be going through. All my feelings hurt."
Her eyes brimmed with unshed tears, and she said,
"Can I tell you something? I want to say it so you know that other people know how you feel. Just a little bit of what you feel, anyway."
"Tell me," I said.
And instinctively I felt a reawakening of the feelings of dread that our reminiscences about Ben had briefly put to sleep.
"I had an abortion."
"When?"
This was startling news. Shocking, too. I thought Laura and I had the kind of friendship where you lay yourself bare. Where the only secrets you keep are to do with your plans for each other's Christmas or birthday presents.
"Before you had Ben."
"I don't know what to say. Why didn't you tell me before?"
"You were pregnant."
And there it was. A wedge in our friendship that I'd never known about.
"Who was the father?"
"You remember Tom from Bath?"
I did. He was a married man who she'd met through work.
"Did he know?"
"He paid for it." "God, Rach, I'm sorry. It's stupid of me even to mention it now. I don't even know why I'm telling you. It's nothing compared to what you're going through."
And here's the thing. I couldn't deal with it.
If Laura wanted us to feel solidarity at that moment, then she'd just said completely the wrong thing. It was simply too much to cope with, the intentional loss of a child. A week previously I would have been there for her, supported her, but at that moment it was viciously, unbearably painful to hear, and my brain, addled with her news, with everything, did a flip. The exquisite and painful pleasure of our reminiscences about Ben disappeared in an instant. The earlier warmth of her friendship and her company suddenly felt frosty and brittle. Goosebumps ran across my skin like squalls agitating glassy water.
"No,"
I said.
"No, no, no. I can't hear this now. Why are you telling me this?"
And then another thought, a corrosive one, as the distrust that my sister had sown as a seed now bloomed freely in my mind. I voiced it with a tone that was raw enough to surprise even myself, the tone of somebody who has reached the end of her tether.
"Are you feeding stories about me to the other journalists? To your friends out there? Is that why you wanted to talk about Ben?"
I got to my feet, and my wine glass tipped over in my hurry to stand, the wine everywhere, pooling on the table, on me, dripping onto the floor. And Laura stood too, and shock had peeled away any softness in her expression, so that her cheeks looked cold and smooth as marble.
"Jesus, Rachel! I know you must be feeling desperate, but..."
I pushed her. She came around the table towards me, wanting to hug me, and I pushed her away. I grabbed her coat and her bag, and I shoved them at her, and I hounded her all the way to the front door, ignoring her pleading words and her tears, until she was out and gone, like Nikki. And the press, her so-called friends, took photographs of her on the doorstep, while I sat back down at the kitchen table, on the chair that was damp with wine. And I sobbed.
Jim. We worked closely with John Finch all day. The feeling of recognizing myself in him didn't abate. If anything, it got stronger as we talked. It troubled me. He waited at Kenneth Steele's house with me, while my officers began checking out families who he'd identified for us. We sent a pair of DCs down to the hospital, hoping there weren't going to be too many confidentiality issues and bureaucratic hoops to jump through before they would release information to us. "Do you ever tire of it?" Finch said to me in a long moment of silence when my thoughts had flown to Emma to when I might see her next. "Do you ever tire of the daily contact with people when their lives are shattered?" We sat in a windowless interview room around a grey top table. A strip light above us threw out a glare that made my temples ache. I didn't answer him. If I had, I would have lost my separateness, my professional distance. I had to remember that John Finch was not my friend, but it was hard not to answer, because there were parallels between what he did and what I do. For a moment or two, I was overwhelmed with a desire to say yes, to talk to him, to compare notes, and admit that there were times when it was very, very difficult to stand back. In another universe, I thought, we might have been able to do that, and it would have been nice, but not here, not now. "Do you know what this room reminds me of?" he asked. I shook my head. "We call it the bad news room at the hospital. It's where we take families when we have to tell them the worst. It's exactly like this, except that there are brochures." I kept my reply neutral. "We're hoping to bring you good news, Mr. Finch." "Do you know how they know?" he said. "The smart ones, the clever families. They see the china teapot and the china cup with saucers and the door closing behind them and the unusual number of staff all together in one room, and they ask themselves, why all this fuss, just for us? Doesn't take them long to work it out. They've read the situation before we've even started talking. They start to grieve before the milk goes into the cups." "Well, you're safe on that count," I said. In front of us was a tray of four polystyrene cups, with grey coffee remains swimming in the base of them. Torn and half-emptied sachets of sugar littered the table like doll-sized body bags. He understood why I'd given such a shallow response. "I'm sorry," he said. "Of course you don't want to have this conversation, because to do so would be unprofessional. That was stupid of me. I'd do the same in your situation." He barked out a noise that was supposed to be a laugh, but instead was a noise that crept sullenly around the edges of the room, mocking his attempt at forced jollity. I wondered then if all the pain and difficulty of his profession, the hopelessness and the encounters with death, had become toxic for John Finch, too toxic to bear any longer. I let my guard down then, just for a moment, because I was curious. "Do you get emotional when you lose a patient?" I asked him. I wanted to know how much failure hurt him. I wanted to know if he was like me. "Very occasionally there's one that gets to you, no matter how hard you try. It's very rare. You learn early on when you're training that you have to keep your distance emotionally, because if you don't, you can't do your job. What makes that one stand out?" "Sometimes you don't even know. Once I operated on a boy who reminded me a little of Ben, and I met his mother. She wasn't unlike Rachel. They reminded me of us, of our family. It wasn't that long ago. Ben was about 7 at the time. The boy's operation was quite a simple one, but there was bleeding, and he died. His heart failed. There was nothing we could do. It was an unexpected death, and when I went to tell his mother, I'm afraid I broke down." Distress swam deep in his eyes, but John Finch had obviously learned to be stoic, too. He didn't lose control. He said, "It was unprofessional of me." "It's understandable." "Do you think so, Detective? Has it ever happened to you?" I looked at my watch. It was late. I was in danger of confiding. I had to get things back on track. "I think we could do with something to eat," I said. "Chances are it's going to be a long night." We took John Finch home at 10 that night. By midnight, we'd narrowed things down based on the information he'd given us, and we had a standout suspect for the letter. By the early hours of the morning, we disturbed countless colleagues, and we were as certain as you can be. We checked and double-checked the details, gone into background, and triple-checked that we had the correct address for our suspect. Fraser, on what must have been her 50th cup of coffee, tasked me with leading a dawn raid. We wanted the element of surprise, and that's the best time to get it. I chose my men, and we went through our preparations carefully. We were due to go in at 5 a.m.
Day 7. Saturday, the 27th of October, 2012. An abduction may occur for many reasons, including a desire to possess a child, sexual gratification, financial gain, retribution, and the desire to kill. Research findings indicate that when a child is killed, the motivation may be either emotion-based, where the abductor seeks revenge on the family, sexual-based, where the offender seeks sexual gratification from the victim, or profit-based, which involves most often ransom for money. Boudreau et al., 2000 and 2001. Moreover, child homicide usually follows an abduction and is not the reason for the abduction. Daly, Marlene L., and Roscoe Jenner. The Abduction of Children by Strangers in Canada. Nature and Scope. National Missing Children Services. National Police Service. Royal Canadian Mounted Police. December 2003. Webpage. www.247news.co.uk/Bristol. 7:22 a.m. British Standard Time. The 27th of October 2012. Where is Benedict Finch? The blogosphere rises. People Power or Vigilante Justice? By Danny Deal. Officers working on the Benedict Finch case have been frustrated by the emergence of a blog, which has stirred up the media frenzy. Apparently, written by somebody close to the case, the blog has been blamed for leaking details of the case and stirring up suspicion against the family of Benedict Finch. DCI Corin Fraser said last night, "We don't know who was writing this blog, but it is a vindictive piece of work. At this time, we are very concerned for the well-being of the family of Benedict Finch, as well as for the lad himself, and we would ask people to remain calm and respect this family situation, and not pay heed to this blog, which is the work of an uninformed and unreliable individual. Our efforts at this time are all concentrated on finding this lad." She also added that police are still pursuing multiple lines of inquiry and are hopeful of a significant development soon. She declined to comment on what that might be. James Leon QC stated that anybody, either a media organization or an individual, can be prosecuted under contempt of court laws if their comments published online are found to be prejudicial at trial. Three people are discussing this article. Donna Folks. People should be able to say what they like. Sean Campbell. If the police can't find him, then at least somebody's saying what everybody's thinking. Amelie Jones. It's stupid to write this and not say what it is that people can't say. Rachel. In the early hours of the morning, I woke to find myself drenched in sweat again, consumed by that scooped-out feeling of loss that was brutal and all-consuming, and was no longer tempered by having people close to me. I began to consider the thought that Ben might not come home. I began to consider the reality that I might have to exist in, should that happen. It would be intolerable. My obsessive, jumpy thoughts drove me downstairs and out of the back door into the night. The wind was still sharp, and it sent me running across the garden to my studio, and in that short distance made its way coldly between the folds of my nightwear, so that by the time I let myself in, I was shivering so violently that I felt like a shaken bag of bones. I didn't dare turn on the lights, in case of being seen through the glass doors, top-lit in all my falling-apart glory. My neighbours, like my friends, felt like adversaries now, potential spies. Instead, I just turned on my computer and sat in its frigid blue glow. Then, compulsively, slowly, knowing that I shouldn't, feeling unable to stop, I began to look online. I found myself castigated further. In the absence of news about the case, editorial pieces had emerged, primarily in the broadsheets. And if I'd ever hoped before reading them that they might provide a more balanced view of our family situation, then I was wrong. Delusional. They were as brutally judgmental as the Red Tops. Almost without exception, they discussed the case and my performance at the press conference in the context of my single motherhood, and they used it as a stick to beat me with, or a label with which to stigmatize me. Those editorial pieces asked a lot of questions about me, and about Ben's case. You can imagine that, can't you? Perhaps you read them. They questioned my morals, and they cast doubt on my fitness to raise a child. They condemned me roundly for my slack parenting and letting Ben run ahead in the woods. They blamed me, made a social pariah of me. Single mother, failed mother, person of dubious social status. Target. Here's what they didn't ask. They showed no curiosity whatsoever about whether I'd considered the decision to let Ben run ahead, or any of the factors I might have taken into account. They didn't examine the sense of loss I had to overcome when John left me, or my efforts at rebuilding, or my longing to be a good mother in his absence. They didn't ask how much I loved Ben. Nowhere did any journalist mention the hardship of single parenthood. The evening spent alone, the pressures of making difficult decisions without support, the painful absence of a partner who might have been there if life had turned out differently. These were people, I thought, with a growing sense of desperation, who would have put me in a workhouse 100 years ago, and a few centuries before that strapped me into a scold's bridle, or built a tall bonfire just for me to sit atop and lit it with flaming torches, which underscored with flickering light their hard-bitten features, their lack of mercy or compassion. And nowhere, in any of the hundreds of words written, did any of them lay a scrap of blame at John's door. In contrast, he was the object of sympathy. Protected by his gender and his profession. Pediatric general surgeon, his new wife a deserved salve for his pain, not a cause of the breakdown of our marriage. One of them even featured a photograph of John and Katrina looking like a perfect unit, irreproachable in their togetherness. I was their target because I was socially unacceptable, and so they did everything they legally could. They publicly lanced me with words which were written, examined, and edited, each process carefully honing them in a calculated effort to push people's buttons once they were published, to froth up public opinion around them so that my situation could titillate others, could thrill and bolster the minds of the smug and judgmental. Schadenfreude. Conservatism. Better the worst happens to somebody else, because, quite frankly, they must have done something to deserve it. And they felt entitled to do that, these so-called thinkers, as they sat comfortably behind their desks with their reference books and their own unexamined moral compass, because I was nothing to them. Ben and I were simply the commodity that would sell their papers, nothing more. And these were the very papers that I used to read, that I used to carry down the road from the shop and bring into my home. It was cowardly, yellow journalism, and I knew that. The problem was, knowing it wasn't enough to stop every single word from chipping away any final scraps of self-respect or dignity that I might have had left. I was only human, after all. And I suppose I'm interested now to know whether it troubles you to read these things. To know that the rug you're standing on so securely can be whipped out from under your feet rapidly and completely. Or do you feel safer than that? Do you assume that your foundations are more secure than mine, and that my situation is too extreme to ever befall you? Have you noted the moments when I made mistakes that you might have avoided? Do you imagine that you would have behaved with a more perfect maternal dignity in my situation? You would be unimpeachable. Perhaps you wouldn't have been stupid enough to lose your husband in the first place. Be careful what you assume, is what I'd say to that. Be very careful. I should know. I was married to a doctor once. I'm also interested to know how uncomfortable you feel now. Whether you're regretting our agreement. Remember the roles we allocated each other? Me, ancient mariner and narrator. You, wedding guest and patient listener. You wish you could shuffle away yet? Refill your glass, perhaps? Now that my grip is loosening, whose side are you on? Mine or theirs? How long will you stay with the underdog, given that she's so beaten now, so unattractive, displaying here and there signs of mental instability? If I were to make a final bid to keep your attention, I suppose I would say that if it troubles you to hear these things from me, to witness my descent, then perhaps you can take heart from the fact that it pains me very, very deeply to confess them. When, finally, the darkness outside my studio began to dissolve that morning, I pulled my chair away from the computer, tore my horrified eyes from the screen. With ice-cold fingers, I pulled my dressing gown around me and I watched the grainy night contours of my garden morph slowly into a strangely lit morning, where the rising sun tinted the pendulous clouds so that they were not entirely black, but coloured instead with bruised fleshy tones, burnished in places. It was the kind of light that nobody would mistake for hope. Back in the kitchen, it felt as though I was meeting my possessions after an absence. I boiled the kettle and realized that I hadn't done that myself for days, because Nikki had done everything. Almost out of curiosity, I opened the fridge, having no idea what was in it, and found cooked meals in labelled containers prepared by Nikki before she left, and half a pint of fresh milk. At the kitchen table, warming slowly as the heating in the house cranked up around me with its familiar clicks and clonks, I began to look at Ben's schoolbooks. There were 5 of them. There wasn't a great deal of work in each one, as it was so early in the school year, but I started to work through them. Maths, literacy, spellings, a history project, and a news book. The first page of the news book made me smile. Ben had drawn a picture of a huge bed, which filled the entire page. In it was a small stick figure. Underneath it, he had written, "I spent the whole weekend in bed." There was a comment beside it in red ink. "Are you sure that's all you did, Ben? I expect you did something else. The drawing of the bed is nice." It even made me smile, because it was nonsense. And I thought simply, this is the world I want to be in. The imaginative, funny world that's my son. I knew then, with perfect clarity, that if Ben didn't survive this, then nor could I.
Jim. 5 of us turned up. Me and 4 men in full gear. Black clothing, bulletproof jackets, caps that hide your eyes, and shoes with soles that were thick enough to do damage. All my men were armed. All of us wore earpieces to keep in radio contact. I was leading. It was 0500 hours. It was dark. Early morning hush was settled over the neighbourhood like a blanket. We parked quietly around the corner, killing the car engine quickly, and when we got out we didn't talk, communicating with gestures only. 3 of us stayed at the end of the driveway, in the shadows and out of sight, and we waited there silently while I sent 2 around the side of the property. We didn't want anybody slipping out of the back. Streetlights revealed that the bungalow was in bad condition, in contrast to the neighbouring properties, which were immaculate, their front gardens displaying neatly trimmed lawns and tended borders, containing closely clipped shrubs like shiny suburban trophies. The flower beds in our bungalow's garden were overgrown, and the lawn was muddy and unkempt, but the metal gate at the side of the house had shiny black paint on it, and its latch didn't squeak when my 2 DCs opened it and sidled through it. My guess was that its decline was recent. There was a single garage to the side of the bungalow. Its door was shut, but in good nick, and the driveway had been expensively relaid at some point recently. There was no crunchy gravel to give us away. There was also no vehicle in the driveway, no curtains drawn at the front, and no lights on in the house. And I hoped to God the place wasn't empty. On my signal, two of the men approached the front door and stood either side of it, tucked in, so that they weren't visible through the frosted glass in the door. Not until they were ready to be. There was a security light above them, but it didn't come on. They had a battering ram with them, a black metal cylinder, so that they could break down the door if necessary. They didn't look at me. They were focused on the door, waiting to hear my voice in their earpieces. "Go," I whispered into my radio. I knew the command would transmit loud and clear, and they didn't hesitate. They rang the bell, hammered on the door, shouted through the letter flap, "Police! Let us in! Police!" The noise ripped through the pre-dawn stillness. By the time a light came on in the hallway of the bungalow, the other properties around us were lit up like Christmas trees, and we were about to bash the door in. A woman opened it. Just an inch or two at first, suspicious eyes peering through. She looked as though she'd been asleep. She wore tracksuit bottoms, plastic clogs, and a nurse's tabard. My men pushed past her. I followed. "Where is he?" I said. She pointed towards the end of the hall opposite. One of my men was already down there, the other had gone into the front rooms. I ran down the hall, but even before I travelled those few paces, I knew it had gone wrong when my man said, "In here, boss," and his voice sagged. He stood in the doorway just ahead of me, and his body language had relaxed, adrenaline gone. There was no threat. As I pushed past him, he said, "He's not going anywhere." In the middle of the room was a hospital bed. In the bed lay a man, his eyes wide balls of fear. He was underneath a white sheet that he'd pulled up to his neck with fingers that scrunched the material tight. A hospital band was visible on his wrist. The only clue to his relative youth was his brown hair. His face hung from his bones and his skin was grey, apart from high red spots on his cheekbones from fever or morphine. He was hooked up to a pump. An oxygen mask was attached to his face, the elastic digging into his cheeks, and a bag of dark orange urine hung from the side of the bed. Beside the bed was an armchair and a table with books on it, along with a laptop computer, a remote control for the TV that sat on the chest of drawers in a corner, and a cardboard tray for collecting vomit. Beside the door was a wheelchair. The nurse was beside me now. "He's dying," she said. She had tribal scars on her face, two rough raised lines on each cheek, and eyes that told me she'd seen death before. I turned to my man. "Search the garage," I said. But I already knew there'd be no sign of Ben Finch.
Rachel. Chang phoned me mid-morning. She'd just parked on my street, she said. And no, they hadn't found Ben, but could I let her in? She wanted to speak to me. I listened at the front door for her footsteps, reluctant to open it until I knew she was there. A peek from my bedroom window had told me that overnight the numbers of journalists had dwindled to just two or three, but I didn't want to give them a photo opportunity. When I heard her footsteps, I heard the journalists call out to her. I began to undo the latch, but the unexpected ring on the bell didn't come. Instead, I heard her curse. I opened the door a crack. My doorstep was awash with milk. It covered the front door and dripped down onto the doormat at my feet. It pulled onto the short front path, and it was littered with broken plastic. A pair of two-pint bottles, my twice-weekly delivery from the milkman, full-fat for Ben and his growing bones, semi-skimmed for me. Smashed to pieces. I pictured hands throwing them, feet kicking them, the impact. The explosion of white liquid, the dirty, messy aftermath, and I knew I was meant to understand it as a rebuke, that it labelled me as a woman with a filthy doorstep. Such an old-fashioned taint that marks you out as the worst sluttish kind of woman. I read it as snide vigilante justice, the domestic equivalent of a white feather through the door. You can see how my mind was rampaging. Now that I was cornered and alone.
"Rachel, go back in," Chang snapped. "I'll deal with this. You go in."
I did as I was told. She borrowed a mop and a plastic bag to gather the debris, and when she came in after cleaning up, I said,
"Do you think somebody did it on purpose?"
"I can't say that for sure. It might have been an accident."
"You know it wasn't."
"I don't know anything."
Did they see who did it?
I gestured towards the journalists.
They say they didn't. They say it was like that when they arrived this morning.
They're liars.
Rachel, it's nothing. It could have been an accident. Don't let it get under your skin.
But it was too late for that. We went down to my studio, taking the dog. I couldn't bear to be near the front door, with its smeary residue of vandalized milk that shamed and frightened me. In the studio, I put the heater on this time, embarrassed in front of Chang to indulge in the pre-dawn masochism that had compelled me to sit in the cold while I looked online. Chang told me about the letter then, and about the dawn raid that had turned up a dying hoaxer.
He was a broken person, she said. His child died during surgery when Mr. Finch was operating.
Was it John's fault?
No. It was a very risky operation. The father had been informed of that, and the child would have died without it. John wasn't at fault. Nobody was.
Was it a boy or a girl?
The child. I don't know. Apparently the death drove the father mad. He'd been bringing the child up alone anyway because the mother had died, also to cancer. He wrote a series of letters to the hospital threatening legal action, but he had no case against them, so he was hopeless. And now he has terminal cancer himself. The whole family, wiped out by that disease.
How did he know about Ben?
He saw it on the telly, recognized John, and he thought it was a chance to get back at him. That's all it was. A spiteful act. I'm sorry. We're not back at square one, though. We've got other avenues to pursue.
Her words were reassuring in themselves, but I could see that it cost her an effort to arrange her features into an expression of optimism. As she stood up to leave, my photographs caught her eye. On the wall above my desk was a collage of pictures I'd taken over the years, and almost without exception, they were portraits of Ben. They were my best work. They were mostly in black and white, and mostly taken on old-fashioned film and developed and printed by me in a dark room I'd rigged up in the garage of our family home. John had been happy to hand the garage space over to me. He wasn't a DIY man. My camera of choice had been a Leica M20, given to me by Ruth and Nicholas. I processed the films myself and spent hours poring over the negatives, deciding which ones to print. The printing process was a joy. The murky red light in which images of Ben emerged from the chemical soup, a kind of alchemy, painting with light, bringing something from nothing. It was a wobbly, unreliable, unpredictable process, yet it yielded images of such beauty and power, and I never tired of it. The photographs I took weren't the brightly lit studio prints that are ubiquitous now, where families are pictured against glaring white backgrounds, mouths agape, dental work on show, in poses they've never before adopted. Artifice, all of it. I preferred to work with light and form, with what was there already. I started with the idea that I would be lucky to capture just a scrap of the beauty of my child. Once, when Ben was about 5 years old, I came downstairs very early one summer morning to find a dawn light so softly crystalline that it seemed to have an ethereal presence of its own. I roused Ben gently, and before he was fully awake, I asked him to sit at the breakfast table. It had been a hot night, and he wore just pajama shorts. He sat and gazed at the camera with a frankness that was perfect. In the finished photograph, it's as if you can see into his soul. His hair is messy, his skin has the texture of velvet, and the contours of his slender arms are perfect. There are no harsh lines in the picture. Blacks fade into greys and into whites, and shadows draw the features of his face and torso. They describe sleepiness and innocence and promise and truth. Only deep in Ben's eyes is there a glint of something that is of its moment. It's a flash of light, a white pearl, and although nobody else could tell, I know that that pearl is the reflection of the window and of me taking the photograph. It's the best photograph I've ever taken, and probably the best I ever will take. Chang stared at that photograph for a very long time. She held her coffee and stood in front of it, and in time, steam stopped curling above her hands. Then she looked at the others, too, the various manifestations of Ben as he was to me. He was a toddler examining something on a summer lawn, with a lightly furrowed brow just visible under a sun hat. He was a close-up of two chubby bare feet, and a study of hands with tiny fragile fingernails and knuckles that had newborn wrinkles, but not yet any solidity. He was his profile, the softness of the skin on his temples, the crisp curls of his eyelashes just visible behind. He was a distant silhouette, jumping a rock pool on a spectacular cliff-edged winter beach. There were so many, and Chang studied each one. Occasionally, her radio made a sharp noise, a crackle, static, or a voice. She ignored it.
"These are just beautiful," she said.
I was lost in the pictures myself when she said it, and her sincerity was unexpected and felt unfiltered.
"You're the first person outside the family to see them," I said. "Truly? I'm honored. I really am."
Her voice caught. She had to take a moment to compose herself.
"I tried to learn photography when I was younger," she said. "My dad bought me a camera, an old-fashioned one. It was a film camera. I was 15 years old. He set me a project. He told me to go out and take photographs. He drove me to a place called Old Airport Road in Singapore, where I grew up, because he was in the army, you see. Anyway, on Old Airport Road, there's an old-fashioned food court. So, you know what I mean. Lots of stalls selling street food of every different kind. A photographer's dream, really. My dad told me to take photographs of the food. I had to ask permission from the stall holders, and my dad sat and watched while I spent ages preparing my shots and looking at the different angles and shapes. And after 2 hours, I'd taken my 24 photographs. We dropped the film off to be developed. I couldn't wait to go and collect it the next day. I was so excited. I had one of those ideas you have when you're young. You know, I'm going to take one roll of film and be a famous photographer. I was that excited. But when I went back the next day and the girl in the shop gave me my packet of photographs, I pulled them out, and every single one of them was black." He was the most I'd ever heard her talk. "What happened?" I asked. "Well, I looked at my dad. I had the same question on my lips, and he said, 'That will teach you not to leave the lens cap on.' I was so angry with him for not telling me."
"Did he know? While you were taking the photos?"
"He did." "That's what he's like, though. He believes you should learn things yourself. Do things the hard way."
She smiled wanly.
"It worked. I never did it again."
"That's what I was trying to do for Ben," I said. She kept her eyes on the photographs. "In the woods. And I let him run ahead. Because I thought that being independent would let him feel life, be enchanted by it, not fear it, or feel that he has to follow a set of rules to get through it. Because it's tough." She said nothing. She turned away for a moment, and the silence was awkward. When she turned back, her eyes were red, and she put a hand on my arm and said,
I'm so sorry, Rachel. I really am.
Once Chang had gone, I went back into the house, driven by the need to be near the landline in case of news. The silence was hard to bear, and I tried to console and calm myself by looking at Ben's books again. I revisited the page where he'd drawn himself spending the whole day in bed, before I turned over to see what he'd written next. The following page was startlingly colourful by comparison. Greenery filled every corner. Trees and plants in strong, confident lines, and a dog that was obviously meant to be Skittle. Short, straight lines slanted across the page, over the other images, as if somebody had spilled blue hundreds and thousands across it. "On Sunday, Mummy and Skittle and me walked in the woods," he'd written. "It was raining all the time." I turned another page. The next week's drawing was very similar. Ben had written, "We walked in the woods again on Sunday. I found a very big stick and brung it home." There was a comment in red ink. "Your walks sound lovely, Ben. Excellent drawing." Another page. A different drawing. A picture of a bowling ball. A crowd of children. "I went to Jack's bowling party and Sam B won," he'd written. Red ink. "Brilliant!" Another page. Trees and foliage again. A swing hanging from a branch. A child beside it, wearing red. Ben was a good artist for his age. The images were clear. "In the woods, I went on a big swing, and Mummy went on her phone." Red ink. "That sounds like so much fun for you." A thud of understanding in my chest that was so violent it felt as though it was knocking the breath out of my lungs. It turned my lips and mouth dry and made me look again at the book, as if my eyes were attached to it by strings, and rifle the pages backwards and forwards until I was sure.
"It's somebody at school," I said,
although there was nobody there to hear me. In response, there was just a single thud from Skittle's tail, an acknowledgement that I'd spoken out loud. With shaking hands, I picked up my phone and I dialed Chang over and over again, but every time I just got a message telling me to leave her a voicemail.
"Jim, a phone call from Emma woke me up. Fraser had sent me home to catch up on a couple of hours' kip since I'd worked through the whole of the night preparing for the raid. The buzzing of my mobile dragged me up out of a deep sleep, where the disappointment that we'd wasted so much time and budget and were no nearer to finding Ben Finch was feeding me vivid, uncomfortable dreams. Emma said she wanted to talk, said she would come over, wouldn't say what it was about. I was out of the shower and dressed by the time she arrived, about to call Fraser to check I hadn't missed anything that morning. 'I'll come down,' I said to the intercom. 'Do you mind if we talk on the drive-in?' I pounded down the stairs of my building, and I took her in a hug when I found her on the pavement outside. But she was somehow awkward, and I only got a bit of a dry-lipped peck on the cheek in return. She had a pool car with her, a green Ford Focus that hadn't been properly cleaned out since a couple of sweaty DCs camped in it for a surveillance job. She handed me the keys. She was old-fashioned like that sometimes. My dad would have loved it. We set off into the city, and within minutes we got locked in a traffic system round Broadmead, where Saturday shoppers and roadworks had brought everything to a standstill. It was one of those moments where it seems surreal that ordinary lives go on around you, that other people can actually afford to tolerate delays, when all you can focus on is a gigantic ticking clock that's in your head, counting time on somebody else's life. We were diverted onto Nelson Street, the city's so-called open-air street art gallery, where graffiti murals covered every dank, depressing concrete facade available. Psychedelic art meets calligraphy meets art deco meets the recesses of the minds of a dozen artists from around the world. A dreamscape all of its own. I waited for Emma to start talking, but the whole time she sat motionless beside me, coat buttoned, collars pulled up, scarf wrapped high on her neck, just staring out front. 'Em,' I said when the silence started to get to me, 'what do you want to talk about?' Still, she said nothing. If anything, her silence seems to have settled deeper on her, like it meant to bury her. I pulled over into a loading bay. What's going on?